copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm the National Director of the FIEC, Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches in the UK. We're about 635 churches across the country. Most of my ministry has actually been as a church planter. So I've planted two churches, and that has given me the privilege of starting a work from scratch and seeking to grow it, which is very different from revitalizing a church. I have had some experience in revitalization. So just to share with you, there was a period of time in which I was part of a Brethren church that needed revitalization. It was a church with a long and proud history, a leadership whose parents and grandparents had been elders in the church before them, that was located in a city centre, and they could look back to sort of 50 years before when they would take 200 children to the seaside for their Sunday school. But now the area where the church was located was a student area, and everybody living all around the church were basically university students. And the result was the church was declining. Most of the elders and members didn't even live in the area anymore. We wanted to see the church revived and make the most of the ministry opportunity on its doorstep. I was there for about 3 years, and it was really about bringing about a revitalization that would prevent the church dying. And very sadly, we weren't able to persuade the elders that that was the way forward. It was really a failed revitalization that led to planting a church. And 15 years later, the church that I'd planted actually bought the building because that Brethren church had died and had closed. So I've been involved in a revitalization that didn't work out, and the pain of having invested a lot of time in a church revitalization only for the leaders and members to say we don't want to change. I was involved in revitalization of the FIEC itself. FIEC is an organization that will celebrate its 100th anniversary last year, but I became national director 11 years ago with a brief really of revitalizing the organization. That's slightly different from a local church, but it had become it's slightly lost its vision, had become perceived as being ineffective and overly conservative. And I was asked to lead a new structure, which involved bringing in new staff and bringing about change. So although it's not a church context, within FIEC, I have been leading a revitalization of an organization. And now the Lord has put us in a place where we are flourishing. So you can see that our old logo was FIEC Bible Churches Together, a little bit dated, symbolized by a new kind of logo, a new image, which just began to speak of the transformation that we underwent. So what I want within FIEC itself, as I said, we've got 635 churches. Many of those churches are small. So there are a large number of churches that would be smaller and more elderly, probably about a quarter of the total number of our churches. One of the things that we've wanted to do is to help those churches to be revitalized. We made that a priority. We appointed a member of staff to lead revitalization. And over the last 3 or 4 years, we've probably helped about 60 churches to seek to be revitalized. Again, not all of those have been successful. Some churches have not wanted to change and are sadly declining and dying. However, a number of churches have been prepared to undergo significant change. And the real delight is in seeing a number of those churches now growing and being thriving gospel work. We've just appointed a new full-time member of staff to help support our smaller churches, of which revitalization is a key aspect. Although I want to say that revitalization is not simply an issue for small churches. Revitalization is vital for all churches that have plateaued in their ministry. You can be a church with a large number of people, but yet in effect need revitalizing because the church is plateaued, is not growing, is not outward looking, and is just beginning the journey to decline and to death. So what I'm saying is not simply for small churches, it's for large churches. What I want to do is talk a little bit about the challenge of leading change, and essentially bringing about revitalization in a church is all about leading change in the life of the congregation, persuading people that something different needs to be done, to often make very hard choices, and to be willing to take those decisions. So I'm really thinking at a leadership level of how do we do this? And I guess there are going to be two key aspects that I think are crucial for leading successful revitalizations or rebuildings. You're going to have someone who's leading, a group who are leading, who have real clarity as to what is needed and are able to persuade others to adopt the changes that are necessary. That's often the significant challenge in revitalization. In our experience, often we found that the barrier to revitalization is members of the church congregation, or particularly leaders who have served the church for many years, who are not prepared to change. And so the crucial question is how to help them to change. I want to do this loosely by just drawing some leadership lessons, which I think are particularly relevant for revitalization from the book of Nehemiah. I take it that you're familiar with the book of Nehemiah. I won't be reading it in any great detail, but the book of Nehemiah, it seems to me, is really relevant and helpful to thinking about this task of revitalization, because Nehemiah is all a book all about rebuilding. You'll remember that the context in Nehemiah is that Jerusalem has been sort of captured. The people have been taken into exile. The temple has been destroyed. The walls have been demolished. And Nehemiah and Ezra are all about the rebuilding of the temple and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. They're a real story of, in a sense, the revitalization of God's people. And I just think that gives us something of it helps us, because what we're seeing is what leadership was required to bring about that rebuilding. So here are some absolutely key lessons, I think, for leading as we seek to help churches to be revitalized. I've got some Q&A questions and answers for you to look at, or some small group discussion questions for you to have a look at after we've looked at this material. And then I'm very happy to answer any questions that you might have. I don't think this is going to be anything that you don't know already, but I hope it will be an encouragement to you to think about how we bring about revitalizations, and particularly what the leadership skills are that are needed, and therefore maybe the kinds of leaders that are needed. So firstly, what is absolutely essential is if we're to revitalize church, we need to know what the problem is. You cannot bring about a revitalization unless you have a clear understanding of the problem. In the book of Nehemiah, it begins with the problem being brought to him. He receives a report about how the walls of Jerusalem have been broken down, the gates burned by fire. So he has a clear understanding of what the problem is. He knows the problem is the demolished walls, the burnt gates, the city is not secure. And he's able to develop his entire approach from that understanding of the problem. Now, of course, he has to interrogate further to discover what the reasons are for that. But I think there's a basic principle there of understanding what the problem is. And I think if we're going to be effective in church revitalization, that is exactly where we need to start. We might see a church that is small, that is declining, that is plateaued. We won't be able to help that church unless we begin by thinking about what the problem is. The presenting problem may be the problem of the decline or the plateauing. We need to interrogate beyond that to discover what is the reason for that. What is the cause of the problem that is facing the church? In other words, what needs to be put right in order for this church to be able to be revitalized and to fulfill the mission, the vision that God could have for it? I think many revitalizations are ineffective because insufficient time is given to identifying what the real problem is. But that is absolutely crucial to being able to change things. Secondly, when we do identify the problem, I think it's right and proper that we grieve over the problem and the present situation. What's very striking in the book of Nehemiah is when he hears about the wall having been sort of broken down, the gates burned. Verse 4 of chapter 1, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before God. There was a real grief at the situation in which God's people and God's city found themselves. And I think we need to have, when we're dealing with revitalization, that same sense of grief and concern for the churches that are declining or dying or plateaued. The honor of God is at stake. It ought to cause us grief that that is the situation. All that we do to seek to bring about change and transformation needs to flow from that heart concern and grief over the current situation. In a sense, we're saying before God, it shouldn't be like this, and we grieve that it is. Engaging in church revitalization isn't simply a job. It's not simply a project that we undertake. I think it needs to flow out of this grief for the current situation of the work of God. If you're not, in a sense, wanting to engage in this work out of a deep sense of grief over the situation of the church, then I suspect that you will find it quite difficult to see it through when it becomes more difficult. So I think a grieving over the present is absolutely crucial. Thirdly, another thing that we learn from Nehemiah is that all of the work needs to be done through prayer. It's all very well talking about management techniques, about how to lead change, how to devise strategic plans, but ultimately, revitalizing and rebuilding the church is a work of God, dependent upon him, and therefore it needs to be conducted with prayer. And actually, we see Nehemiah praying all the way through the book. As soon as he hears news of the situation in Jerusalem and he grieves, his response is to turn to God in prayer, to confess the sins of God's people that have led to this situation falling on the city. So he cries out to God in confession, asking that God would be merciful to his people. A couple of chapters later, when he has an opportunity to ask King Artaxerxes to allow him to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls, he prays to God that God would grant him that opportunity in that conversation, a conversation that can be a crucial turning point in the moment of revitalization. Nehemiah prays. When he's facing opposition, and there are those who are trying to prevent him from rebuilding the walls, Nehemiah again prays against those who are opposing him. And then finally, at the end, as he comes towards the end and the work is finished, he prays. He prays that the Lord would remember him and the work that he has done. So the entire work of rebuilding and revitalizing is done covered in prayer. And I think when we think about revitalizing and rebuilding, it's not that we make plans and just ask God to bless them. We need to be committed to praying at every point of the process, confessing where we failed that has led to the situation of the church, praying for opportunities, praying for conversations that might lead to change and transformation, praying where we face opposition, and praying that God would honour the work that is done. It is a spiritual work that we are involved in. Fourthly, and this is an extension of the idea of understanding, identifying the problems. Having grasped the general problem, before he embarks on building the walls, rebuilding the walls, Nehemiah, in Nehemiah chapter 2, inspects the whole of Jerusalem. He takes the time to walk around the walls to see what the situation is in order to consider what needs to be done. He does a detailed inspection that enables him to fully understand the problem, to grasp what will be needed in order to change things and bring about a restoration. So Nehemiah invests significant time before embarking on the work in understanding in detail these two key things. He first wants to assess the need. In other words, he has to understand what the issue is, what needs to be done. Again, it's perhaps obvious in his case, the walls are demolished, the gates are burnt, but the scale of the need is perhaps what he grasps by wandering around the church. Now, I think that what this means when we're thinking about revitalization, is that if we want to lead through change, we need to invest a lot of time in listening and understanding what is going to be needed to bring about change. So it's easy to come to superficial judgments as to what we think is needed and what could be changed. I think when, for example, I was involved in the Brethren Church in Birmingham, we could see that the student community wasn't being reached, but I hadn't really grasped some of the historical and cultural reasons that were preventing the leadership from wanting to grasp that opportunity. Actually, the need was for re-envisioned leaders because they didn't have a vision for what God had put in front of them. Instead, they were living with a nostalgia for a previous ministry and thought that faithfulness simply meant doing what their fathers and grandfathers had done. So I don't think I properly understood what the need was, and therefore we didn't approach change in the right way. We hadn't got to the root of what the problem with the church was. So in undertaking revitalizations, you have to do this work of finding out what the real difficulty is. Has the church lost the gospel? Has the church lost the ability to contextualize and bring the gospel to bear to the people? Is the issue a lack of money and resources? Is the issue a lack of leadership quality? Or is the problem a particular leader or a group of members who are determined to prevent any change because they're comfortable? They don't really want to pursue a gospel vision. What are the real reasons? Is the building in a poor state of repair that is off-putting to those who are on the outside? Now, there can be a multiplicity of reasons why a church needs to be revitalized, but it's absolutely crucial to try to understand fully what those reasons are. Otherwise, you won't be bringing about the change that's needed. And one of the dangers in revitalization is bringing about significant change that doesn't solve the problem. You can invest a lot of time and energy in things that do not change the real problem. So if the real problem is a leadership mindset, updating, say, for example, the singing, the Bible version, making the building more attractive, all of those things are not going to solve the problem. You need to know what the real need is. And then it's from the real need, understanding what the need is, that you need to be able to adopt a plan. In order for a revitalization to take place, someone or a group of people in the church need to have clarity of a plan of what needs to be done. In other words, somebody has to have an understanding of where the church needs to go and what needs to change. So there needs to be a clear route map of what you're seeking to accomplish in order for the church to be revitalized. Now, that route map, that plan, might be formed in a variety of ways. It may be a visionary individual who can see what the right direction is, who can see the needs of the church and has a clear sense of what needs to change in order for things to be turned around. Or it may be that that plan is brought about as a result of consultation, maybe with key people in the church or the congregation as a whole. But either way, there needs to be a clear plan adopted, a route to follow to bring about change in the church. And I think it's the key task of the people who are leading a revitalization to have a clear plan, to have a sense of the steps along the way of that plan. In other words, it's very easy to see where you want to get to in the end, but you need to work out what are the intermediate steps that will get you there. And also wisdom about the likely timescale for what can be accomplished. So you need not only to have a sense of the plan and what needs to be done, but a sense of the time that it will take to bring that plan about. And in most cases, I think in revitalization, there is a real need for long-term patience. Change rarely comes quickly. Change will take time. And in most cases, change will be brought about by introducing a series of small steps towards the ultimate goal of radical change. So having a clear plan of what needs to be done, and Nehemiah was able to devise a clear plan for how the walls were to be rebuilt. And he had this vision of all of the people together coming and building the different parts of the walls and the gates, building the gates and then building the walls to connect with each other. So he had a clear sense of what needed to be done and how it could be accomplished. Next, even if you've got a plan, and even if it's a good plan, it doesn't mean that the people and the church will necessarily follow it. And one of the keys in leading transformation and change in churches and organizations is persuading people to adopt the plan, even when the plan might involve costly decisions. The plan might involve people stepping down from positions of leadership. It might involve people giving more. It might involve cultural change in the life of the church. It might involve something as radical as a whole new group of people coming and joining the church. It might involve the church being brought under the wing of a larger church and basically becoming a congregation of a bigger church. So the plan might involve all of those things, but it will almost certainly involve costly action. And so the challenge is to persuade people that it's worth it, and to persuade people to bear the cost of change. Change is almost never pain-free, and we need to persuade people that it is worth the pain because of the benefits that will come in the end. So again, Nehemiah, having devised a plan for how the wall is to be rebuilt, what he does is he then speaks to the people to urge them to rebuild the walls. He presents them a vision of the rebuilding and what the rebuilding will accomplish. It's there in chapter 2, verses 17 to 18. Let me just read that. I think it's verses worth reading. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. And then the response, they replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. That's what envisioning is all about. You want to be able to encourage and persuade the people so they're enthusiastic to do the work of rebuilding, that they see it as being a good work. And there are a number of things that Nehemiah did to envision the people. He was honest with them about the problem. He said, look, it's in ruins. Part of envisioning is helping people to face up to reality. But then he encouraged them that the work could be done. Let us rebuild. He wanted them to see that it was a possibility that this situation could be reversed. Then he wanted them to see the benefits. Then we'll no longer be in disgrace. Now, in effect, he's saying both it's in your interests and God's interests. You'll no longer be in disgrace. God's reputation will no longer be in disgrace. Can you see? He's wanting them to see that this is a work really worth doing, no matter how hard it might be. And he encourages them that God is gracious. As I told them about the gracious hand of my God on me. So in the end, he urges them to rely on God and not on themselves. So he envisions them by telling them the truth about the situation, by giving them encouragement that it can be changed, by showing them the benefits and the blessings of change, and by encouraging them to look to God as the one who can meet their needs. I think that summarizes the work that we're doing of envisioning people for change. Now, I don't think this is something that is done just once. It needs to be done again and again and again and again. in a revitalization project and process, you need to keeping the people on board. Because usually what's needed is change after change after change after change. And they need to know that it's possible, that it's worth it, that God will be with them. And I think that in persuading churches to change, this element of envisioning the people is often the most crucial element to help them to accept difficult change. And of course, the problem is that if you're the leader, you're already convinced of the need for change. And one of the real challenges in leadership is that you tend to think everybody already thinks what you think. And you need to just keep reminding yourself that they either forget or that they don't think in that way. And you therefore need to keep on envisioning. Now, having done that, you can begin to embark and continue the work of revitalization. So one of the key things you'll then need to do is to bring about the change. You need to deploy your resources. So hopefully, having worked out a plan, seen the need, you'll know what needs to change. You've got a sense of what needs to be provided, the kind of people that you might need, perhaps some material changes that might be necessary. And then you're able to begin to deploy, to organize and use those resources to bring about the change. So that's exactly what Nehemiah does in chapter 3. The people are divided up. They all take different sections of the wall. They all work on their section of the wall. The materials are provided for the repairs to be made and the rebuilding happen. So the whole people are brought in together to work on this project. And again, I think if you're revitalizing a church, if you can, you want to bring in as many of the people who are part of the church to join the new work of bringing about change. So change is not something you impose on people, but change is something that everybody joins in and everybody helps to bring about. There's a large measure of wisdom in deploying your resources, in using people in the best ways, in making sure that the workload is manageable in order for the task to be accomplished. Well, next, I think when we're bringing about change, we should expect that there will be opposition. So as we go into revitalization, or change in any church or institution, opposition is almost inevitable. There will be people who do not want to see change. Now, in the case of Nehemiah, that was largely opposition from outside, enemies of the people of Israel who did not want the walls to be rebuilt. And so they seek to conspire against him. Now, we may face external enemies, but often in church revitalizations, what we discover sadly is that the enemies are within. They're often people within the church who do not want change to be brought about. And it's worth understanding often why that is. Often it's because the people who are inside the church, for two main reasons. One reason is because they're comfortable with things the way they are, and people don't want to have to change their habits. They're very reluctant to change the service times, the service patterns. They're very reluctant to give up offices and functions that they might have. They're comfortable and they don't want the extra effort of having to change. But for some, it's a matter of pride. Very often in smaller churches that are declined, there are leaders who have kept things going through the period of decline. And they see themselves as having been faithful. We were the ones who kept things going when it could have closed years ago. We've given our lives to this church. It's still here because of us. And those people find it very difficult to perhaps recognize that although they've kept the doors open, they've actually failed to grow the church. They've failed to fulfill the mission of the church. And therefore, for them, to accept that change is needed is actually admitting that they have been wrong, or they've not been as effective as they should have been. And therefore, it's a matter of pride that they cannot admit that there is a need for change. Sadly, in some churches that are small and dying, there is an attitude amongst either the congregation or the leaders that we would rather close the doors and think we've been faithful to the end than make changes that might need to lead to new life. Now, opposition, wherever it comes from, needs to be addressed. It can't simply be ignored. One way of resisting opposition is to keep on envisioning, to try to win opponents over to the vision, to show them the benefits and blessings of transformation. But sometimes opposition simply needs to be fought because it will be intractable and it won't change. And again, Nehemiah, there was a point at which they were building the walls with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other in order to deal with the danger of the opposition. Most revitalization projects, leaders will face a mix of some people who are really encouraged and enthusiastic about the prospects for change and are completely behind them, and others who deeply oppose them. Next, just as we think about this whole aspect of revitalization, I think it's really important that we bear in mind that what ultimately we're seeking and what is needed is a spiritual renewal of the church. That in the end, that is the work that God needs to do, is a revival and a renewal of his people, a renewed confidence in him, confidence in the gospel, a renewed willingness to serve him and be committed to him. It's not simply a problem of externals or of numbers, but there's a need for genuine spiritual renewal. The problem of bringing about change in these situations is not simply managerial. It's a spiritual issue. And again, we see that in Nehemiah. Nehemiah, in the end, brings about not just the rebuilding of the walls, but the renewal of the people. In the second half of the book, the law is read to the people. They corporately confess their sins. As we see in the book of Ezra, the covenant is renewed and they recommit themselves to serving God. And that pattern of kind of confession, repentance, renewal, and recommitment is what we want to see in the lives of churches where revitalization is necessary. And then lastly and finally, I think it's crucially important that we celebrate what's accomplished. Celebration of what God has done is crucial to encouraging people to persevere, to keep making changes. We want to give thanks to God for what he has brought about. And again, that is what happens towards the end of the book of Jeremiah after the wall is rebuilt. Once the wall is rebuilt, Jeremiah basically conducts a dedication ceremony. There are two choirs that walk around the wall and eventually meet, singing and celebrating in their procession. We're told in chapter 12 and verse 43 that there is great rejoicing and the people offer sacrifices. So the people recognize that this transformation is the result of God's work, so that they give the glory and the praise to him. If you're somebody involved in church revitalization, this ought to be where you want to see it end, with the people in the church that have been revitalized giving thanks to God. Don't start by hoping that they'll give thanks to you for having led the church through the revitalization. What you want is for them to be giving thanks
himself, as the one who has brought about and accomplished this work. So there are some leadership lessons as to what I think is needed where we're dealing with revitalization. They're in a way very practical and in some sense I would have hoped quite obvious, but we need to apply them in this context. We've got to identify the problem. Why is revitalization needed? We should be grieving over the present situation. All our work needs to be done in prayer. We need to understand what the obstacles are to bringing about change, which will mean finding out what the needs are devising a plan to meet them. We're going to have to constantly keep envisioning the people that change is worth it and possible. Use our resources well, resist opposition, and then let's not forget that ultimately it's about spiritual renewal, and that we want to celebrate and give thanks to God to what he's achieved. And I would suggest when we're in a revitalization, it often doesn't happen all at once. And we need to give thanks to God for every step forwards that is made. Every step, every bit of progress is an opportunity for giving thanks and for re-envisioning the congregation for the next step. Well, I hope that's been helpful to you as just a brief overview of some of what is needed. You're all experienced leaders. In a way, I hope I've not done anything other than remind you of what you already know. But I hope that helps you think about how it might apply, particularly to the context of revitalization. Thank you. God bless.